In the 100th birthday year of the American avant-garde composer John Cage, many cultural institutions are celebrating his deeply influential life's work. But celebrating Cage is a lot more elusive than celebrating, say, Debussy. Composing with open-ended concepts that often didn't even include notes and rests, Cage threw so much responsibility onto the performers and audiences that it's hard to know what to celebrate. When his songbooks are performed Friday at the new music warehouse venue Fidget Space, there may not even be any designated singers, but dancers, performance artists, and guitarists. That kind of freedom might sound easier than the usual, but the Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns discovered hidden burdens in Cage's brand of anarchy.
John Cage threw out all the basic rules,
traditional notions of self-expression, creative choice,
preferring techniques that challenge performers to leave behind everything they know and perhaps tap into the cosmic hum of the universe. Sometimes the result was silence, as in his greatest hit, 4 minutes and 33 seconds of silence. Certainly Cage's music doesn't look like anybody else's. Leaf through Cage's songbooks, and on page after page, you'll find no semblance of traditional musical notation. Fidget Space co-director Peter Price performs a John Cage song of sorts, written for the electronic devices of his choice, radios, for example, with directions on how to position the knobs, but with an open-ended sense of what might come out of them.
He doesn't care what they do, so he gives you a knob number and a sort of position for the knob. He's basically provoking you into creating a whole electronics setup of your devising that then you have to follow the score, but the results are completely indeterminate.
The closer you look at Cage's music, the more challenges and contradictions arise that must be solved, not just with creativity, says Peter Price, but with ethics.
There's a score, for instance, that the instruction says, do not perform this score for longer than 3 minutes and 43 seconds, right? But one of the instructions is, take your temperature. In an hour, take it again. So what does that mean? How do you interpret that performatively? What are you supposed to do with that seeming disconnect? And those kind of things come up in Cage all the time. And if people just gloss over them because they haven't really paid attention, when it comes time for the performance, they're going to be doing something that really is not so related to what the scores actually say.
The results are often unimposing. Cage is famous for the prepared piano, in which the instrument's sounds are altered by installing screws and coins into the interior strings, creating sounds that are less definable and more contemplative. Some Cage works seem to drift in and out of being. That's why Price has Cage concerts in his intimate loft, the Fidget Space.
He does have a sort of commitment to what he would call small sounds.
It's possible to be eternally grateful for Cage without actually liking his music. The venerable Philadelphia composer George Crumb, a Pulitzer Prize winner, was creatively at sea in the early 1960s when teaching at the University of Colorado. Then along came Cage for a guest residency.
He had that quality about him. He fired up composers to think in different ways and to explore themselves in quite unconventional ways, I think, to sort of forget all of the academic training that they'd ever had in their lives and try to hit on something, you know, inside. So he had that effect on me.
Crumb went on to become one of the most original composers of his generation, yet that didn't make him a kindred spirit. Crumb's pieces tend to have their own sense of beginning, middle, and end, and at least subliminally adhere to the basic notions of Greek proportions. And Cage didn't much like that.
He said, I've heard some Crumb music recently. It's not the kind of music I like because it's effective. I don't like effective music. And I took it as a compliment, but assuredly he didn't mean it as a compliment, you know. He thought there was something immoral maybe about effective music. I always thought music always had to be effective, but he didn't.
And Crumb can't cotton to Cage's methods.
I think it's a little bit insincere because the performer is doing all the work. The performer is creating the piece, you know. And yet Cage signs his name to it and gets royalties. That's the only thing I have against it. And one wonders why you should spend so much effort, you know, trying to polish a few notes of music, and then this guy can produce 100 pages, each one a separate little piece, you know, and those things are sold all over the world, and they're rather expensive, too.
Dustin Hurt, founder of Bowerbird, the organization that produced the Great Morton Feldman Festival in 2010, admits to having been skeptical when he first began formulating his Cage Beyond Silence Festival, which now includes 21 concerts in various Philadelphia venues, including the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Now, Hurt is quite the Cage advocate, but it's not easy to remain so.
He's got like a PR problem. I think there's a lot of people that think he was this mad scientist, and his use of chants is also maybe not so much misunderstood, but like treated in an undifferentiated kind of clump, as if like everything after 1952 that involves chants was done in the same way and done randomly and haphazardly, and that really wasn't the case. Ultimately, this guy was an ingenious composer who had a really subtle ear, had extraordinary taste in music.
The meaning of Cage's music often has to be assembled by listeners, and they aren't always used to looking into themselves for that. It's work, but help is on the way. The Philadelphia Museum of Art's Dancing Around the Bride exhibition, which refers to the Marcel Duchamp artwork, encompasses his collaborations with choreographer Merce Cunningham and, of course, John Cage. The juxtaposition of like-minded artists will no doubt help illuminate and foster appreciation for them all. But the rewards aren't typical, says co-curator Carlo Besualdo, who summed up the desired impact with a quote from the French philosopher Gilles Deleuze.
To be in the middle of everything and in the center of nothing, that's a position that we hope the spectator will occupy. Because it's a way of engaging the viewer and making it part of the experience of the show. There is no one center.
One of the most lavish artifacts to come out of the John Cage anniversary so far is a new recording of his sonatas and interludes that seeks to give the music every benefit of the doubt by lining up all acoustical factors in its favor. The recording by pianist Nurit Tillis was produced with the utmost care, using Cage's original screws to prepare the piano and then issuing it on 3 vinyl discs played back at 45 RPM to achieve maximum definition. It will sell in museum gift shops for around $140. Executive producer Anthony Creamer, who supports many Philadelphia new music projects, believes that as pretty as the music might be, it's anything but a mere bath for the ears. To get anything meaningful out of it, one must listen carefully to the succession of sounds. You're not going to hear this music very often, partly because Cage's ideas could be impractical. Composers like Crumb get extended piano effects with the use of hands, not screws. Even Peter Price balks at having his piano prepared Cage style.
There's always a concern. I mean, when you have the beautiful, shiny new instrument and someone's coming at it with a bunch of screws.
Most people can't live so far from their comfort zone as Cage seemed to for his entire life. In one of his notoriously discursive lectures, the composer offered, in his eerie, half-whispered voice, a challenging mantra for where he thought composers should be.
You can't tell where you are, and you don't know where you're going.
That was in 1989. Only a few years before his death, and even then, he was devising new ways of creating music.
You take some paper and you turn the two-dimensional thing into a ball so that it's completely crumpled. And then, of course, you flatten it out and you read it as, with a grid and whatnot, you read it as indications of whatever aspect of music you're then noticing.
You heard right. Crumple up a piece of paper, unwrap it, and have the crumples guide your composition. And herein lies perhaps the biggest barrier to understanding Cage. You get the concept and turn your brain off to the rest of it. That was my reaction when I saw Cage's Euro operas in the late 1980s. It was an entire evening of singers wandering about the stage, singing a phrase from one aria or another, wearing the hat from one character and carrying the spear for another. Oh, I see. It's an operatic garage sale, I thought. And I was probably right. But I didn't go further than that. Cage believed, if you're bored, you don't stop listening.
but redouble your efforts and listen harder to discover something else. Maybe not in the piece, but in yourself.
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. John Cage songbooks will be performed at the Fidget Space at 1714 Master Street in Philadelphia on Friday at 7. Cage Beyond Silence, a major festival celebrating the music of John Cage, takes place at the Philadelphia Museum of Art and venues across the city from October 26th through January 20th.
Everything you hear on WRTI is made possible by members. Please join today.